Hello, everybody. Welcome to the podcast. Today I'm going to talk about Lyme disease. Lyme disease is something of a difficult subject. There are many points of view. A lot of people are on the internet inquiring about it. It's a subject which is subject to incredible controversies. And my contribution is just going to be to open discussion around what I've learned based on my own struggles. I've had quite an experience with Lyme disease, and I thought it might be useful to others. Now, let me clarify before I begin that I'm just sharing questions that I think would be good for everybody to research themselves. Please don't listen to me. I don't have any qualifications as a medical doctor. I've done a lot of research, and I am a former academic, but this is a subject where you want to get technical advice from your physicians for sure. So please don't listen to me for answers, but perhaps I can lead you to some really good questions. So in summary, I don't have definitive answers. I only have unresolved questions. This process has helped me an awful lot in finding relief from my own case, which was fairly severe. It has been helpful, and this process of inquiry has been helpful in dealing with Lyme disease. What I'm going to focus on, I should clarify, is the longer-term aspects of Lyme disease, not the short-term. In the short-term, folks go to their doctor, they're treated with antibiotics, and it's really quite successful, and there just aren't any issues. But that's not always the case. In fact, there's a very significant portion of people that continue to have problems. I believe, you can check me on this, but Dr. Zhang at Johns Hopkins has said it's now up to 2 million people with continuing issues. So this podcast is just a discussion that will help, I hope, help folks begin their own inquiry and narrow the questions and help them find a path that will be good from their point of view. It's not medical advice. So it's about persisting symptoms. It's not about the case where you might have an encounter with ticks and Lyme and it goes away. What I'm going to be talking about is when symptoms persist. And again, you want to get very high quality medical advice, not less. So this is no substitute. And the issues are complicated. And it becomes quite ideological. Folks divide into camps. And they're very, very different perspectives. They're even different names. Some people talk about a persistent Lyme disease. Other folks talk about a Lyme disease, post-Lyme disease syndrome. The difference here is whether you believe that there might be bacteria still in your bloodstream after antibiotic treatment, or if you believe there is none, but the persisting symptoms have to do with effects on immune system and other things. From my point of view, this is ideological and highly unresolved and requiring more research. For many of the people participating in the controversy, however, you will find that they feel it is resolved. And the Infectious Disease Society of America, which consists of highly trained, eminent, a wide range of very highly qualified physicians throughout the United States, they have converged on the idea that live bacteria do not generally persist, and the best approach is really to avoid further antibiotics, but to consider other methods of treatment or symptom relief. Now, my one major reason for this podcast really is because from an outsider, it's my opinion, and this podcast consists really pretty much of my opinions throughout. Please think of it as my opinions and no certainties anywhere. But my opinion is the two sides aren't really listening to each other that well. There are some doctors that bridge the divide very well, and they are very good listeners. But in general, there's not a lot of listening. So this phenomenon then is going to lead me to my own conclusion that the best thing for me to do was to very carefully make use of what is known by the traditional approach, the IDSA approach, take that as far as I can go, but to also consider whether the other point of view has some value. So my approach has been to find both kinds of doctors to advise, first relying initially on the IDSA approach, which has been beneficial, but I have found benefits from the other approach as well. If you choose your physicians carefully, you can find both with stellar credentials. So that's a kind of a background to what I'm going to be talking about here. And the next thing I like to do is just a little bit in my amateurish way summarize the basic problem. The basic problem is that for most bacteriological infections, they can take a sample of blood and they can take it away to a laboratory and culture it and see if they can grow the bacteria, which enables them to identify it. So the historical problem with Lyme disease is that they haven't been able to culture Lyme. In other words, they take a blood sample, and the technology has not been there. Perhaps it's under development. We always hope for that. But the technology has not been there to enable the laboratory to culture the Lyme and get a definitive answer to the question. At this stage, perhaps after antibiotic treatment, do I still have live bacteria in my system or not? Now, this is not to say that there aren't tests. There is a widely accepted and used test, or I should say a combination of two tests that your standard physician has available. It's not really too helpful in the first days because it's a serological test that looks at antibodies, and those take a while to develop. IgG and IgM come forward at different rates, but to get a definitive answer, you kind of have to wait a little while. So that's a bit of a worrisome thing if you think you might have Lyme infection, but the early tests aren't reliable for a while. So this basic problem, that there's no test, has led to what some have called the Lyme Wars, the Lyme disease wars, where folks who believe that the bacteria can persist are in a major controversy with the majority of infectious disease doctors who believe that the Lyme bacteria, the spirochetes, do not persist, or at least they're so diminished in numbers that the immune system can handle it. So we find a situation where after initial treatment with antibiotic, and both sides of the controversy will treat with antibiotics, the difference comes with the question of how long and what about after the first treatment. I mean, Lyme disease can develop through various stages, which I'm sure you can read about if you consult the internet. And as it progresses, even the doctors who don't believe in long-term Lyme infection do recognize that if it's untreated initially, it can advance through your system, come to what you might think of as disseminated Lyme disease, and they will treat with antibiotics, even intravenous. And that notion of intravenous is kind of an important factor to consider, because intravenous antibiotics bring a certain amount of risk, and you can understand why the IDSA doctors would not like folks to be taking long-term intravenous antibiotics if there's no real proof or evidence or consensus that the bacteria are still living in one system. They wouldn't want you to, because there are dangers of infection which on occasion can be extremely serious and really major. So there's good thinking behind the fear of antibiotics, but one thing that you begin to learn as you work your way into this subject is that some doctors who believe that the spirochetes have not died or may not have died wouldn't use intravenous antibiotics. They would use oral ones. So there's a difference there. And sometimes when you hear about the risks of continuing antibiotics, I believe it's necessary to contrast the difference in risk between the two. Not to say that there aren't risks with oral antibiotics. There certainly are, but the question is there a major difference in level of risk? So that's the general problem, and you'll find all kinds of things on the internet about this. Some people who suffer long-term from Lyme feel very strongly that the doctors haven't listened well, and that their descriptions of problems were kind of overlooked a little bit. A group put together a film even on this. I'm not a big fan of the film because it comes across to me like a very heavy-handed approach. I won't say really a propaganda film, but it's so heavy-handed. And for myself, I like to keep a balanced mind about things. If I were an IDSA doctor, I think I'd be alarmed at that film. On the other hand, there are many people who have felt actually hurt by the fact that they go to doctors and the doctors dismiss the problem, say it's psychological, whatever they might say. Although I should mention that this phenomenon of dismissive response when you go into the doctor, that might be decreasing a lot because the whole medical community is awakening to this issue of persisting symptoms after Lyme disease. And I think people are becoming more open-minded, and even the IDSA, folks with IDSA approach now have clinics and support for folks who have continuing symptoms, and they try to help with symptoms and whatever. I think there was actually a controversy within medicine where the Institute of Medicine raised questions about IDSA's lack of, I wouldn't say empathy, doctors tend to be overall fairly empathetic, but a lack of responsiveness to the patient perspective, let me put it that way. And I think they took a position, and I think generally physicians I don't know who's done a survey, I don't know the overall thing, but I find that if you go to a number of physicians, and I've been to quite a few, a lot of them can be quite kind about it. Others are technicians, they're really engineers of the human body, and you would expect that they would go with the recommendations they get from the IDSA and others. So that's an overview of the basic problem. Now, to give a little perspective this, I'm just going to go over a little bit about my own experience. Way back before Lyme was really in the headlines, before there was much awareness, I moved to an area where it turned out ticks and Lyme was endemic. Over time, we found this was a neighborhood where so many people get Lyme disease multiple times. You know, just almost everybody you talk to has an experience with it. But way back in 1990, not much was known about it. And I work outside a lot, working on a cruising sailboat that I had. I was bitten, and I did have the rash, and I had certain diagnostic symptoms, which are classic, which would help to diagnose. Classic symptom, my right knee became extremely sore, painful, arthritic, swollen, quite a classic symptom. If you look it up, the knees are susceptible, large joints, the knees are very susceptible. I went to the doctor, of course, but who can blame the doctor? He was just completely dismissive, said it's probably a spider, even though I had read up on Lyme and asked for a test. And I believe, I'm not sure about this, but I believe the tests were not as reliable in those days. So I'm not one to blame any doctor for anything. They're all generally doing the best they can. But the point is, symptoms continued, and it wasn't treated. And for a decade, I had symptoms. So if I went into a store, the grocery store, for instance, where they have shelves that go up over my head, I'm not that tall, but if I look up to the top shelf, I couldn't look up because my neck would hurt. And I continued with real pain in my right knee, and I had a fluid bulge in my right knee, I guess you call it synovial fluid, and I even had a lost feeling, a 2-inch diameter of skin, lost feeling. And I had many other symptoms I won't go into, only because Lyme disease tends to be associated with migrating symptoms and such a range of them. It's one of the problems, it's one of the reasons why the IDSA and the medical community generally wants to be careful about people diagnosing Lyme too easily and prescribing all kinds of antibiotics because the symptoms are so varied and complicated, and it's kind of hard to pin down without a lot of experience. So who would want a lot of people taking antibiotics if in fact they do not have a condition where that would help. Anyway, I even had brain fog, and my fogginess, I fell going down the basement steps. Anyway, as this progressed, I did go to my standard doctors. It's not like I ignored all of this. And there was a variety of responses. I have the most wonderful, compassionate doctor who is both a scientist and a physician. He, just absolutely, absolutely magnificent. And he has helped me all through this process, even though he himself is well-educated in the standard IDSA philosophy toward all of this. But my approach has been always to go to all the referrals that a standard doctor would give me and pursue the theories that one must pursue in case this is not really Lyme disease. So for one example, I went to a rheumatologist, and there I was with a swollen knee, and at that point it had gone into an elbow also. And he started to go through the possibilities and whatever, and I just mentioned to him, I said, and by the way, there's very clear clinical evidence that I did have Lyme disease quite a while back. I thought you should know that. Well, he cut me off immediately. He just said, you do not have Lyme disease. Now, this is understandable because these doctors do seminars, and they're very eminent medical minds who are really set in their belief that there is no persisting Lyme infection. And they live in fear that doctors will get the wrong impression from all the public outcry. And so a lot of these doctors have seminars where they're really warned about the ethics of just taking somebody who wanders in thinking they have Lyme disease and going with their theories. So I'm very supportive of the rheumatologist who cut me off. I understand why that is. And actually, we remained friends. I quite admire his mind. When my wife and I went to Europe, we shared photographs and things. An important part of all of this is to be understanding of other people. And I think a big problem with much of American culture is people have too much attitude, and they get, you know, hot emotions way too easily. And I believe in the mildness and understanding the people that I deal with. So I did have the experience of being dismissed, but that was just useful information to me because that told me, aha, a rheumatologist specializing in arthritis doesn't have solutions. So how valuable. I was glad that I was sent there and I got good information, even if it wasn't like a solution to the whole problem. But that was just one stepping stone. I had night sweats going on for the longest time, for years, and they were very frequent. And my PCP, who's so supportive and pursues every avenue for me, was concerned. And the way he is open-minded and supportive and wonderful, he said, Larry, I think maybe you should see an infectious disease doctor. Well, I'm sure, I don't know this for a fact, but I'm sure he has had lectures from the eminent lead scientists who advised the IDSA, and many doctors in our Boston area do have continuing education on these topics. But there he was, opening the perspective, you know, not just saying, well, it must be psychological. He just keeps investigating the possibilities. Well, I'm kind of an independent thinker myself. So when he said that, I said, okay, I happen to know from reading about other diseases that there are geographical differences. There are medical cultures and geographical differences around the country and how folks look at things. And I said, so I've seen some doctors in this circle. Let's just take the doctor's advice, go to an ID doctor, but we'll pick one who might have a slightly different perspective. So I did my research, and I decided to go to a highly endemic area where there are a lot of wealthy people, where there was the possibility of thousands of patients and very long experience. In other words, somebody that really had worked clinically with Lyme disease over a long period. And I was so fortunate, I'm going to mention his name here because I admire him so much. I was so fortunate to find Dr. Dante. He's retired, no longer practices. But you can check me. I think I recall he had close to 100 peer-reviewed publications. So he's a recognized researcher and scientist, but also a clinician very interested in people. And so I went to see him. And his experience had been a little bit against the IDSA, but not really. He was open-minded, and he would not say, oh, they're all wrong. You know, we know what to do here. Let's load you up with antibiotics. He simply said that the tests aren't that reliable. And in his experience, when people come in, if you look at the clinical patterning and see that it really quite certainly seems to be a Lyme phenomenon, as it was in my case, that something he had found useful, now remember, this is thousands, I think 10,000 patients, useful, was to take a safe antibiotic that he had reason to believe was actually very effective for Lyme, actually more effective than standard doxycycline, which is used, and to use it for a longer period, but not in some wild sort of way, but experimentally. He said, if it doesn't help, just stop. And he said, it's not going to be open-ended, but it can also be a little bit diagnostic, because if when you start taking it, you start to get some worsened symptoms, that can be the Herxheimer reaction showing that there are secondary effects as bacteria are being killed. So I started down that path. And I started taking tetracycline. Now, recall the tetracycline is, I mean, you can check me on this, but I guess it has often been used for acne, for various things, for very long periods. My expectation was it would take a year to 18 months to really get the full effect. But I started out, and sure enough, I had all the symptoms that I had had off and on in varying degrees. I had pretty bad symptoms within the first 3-4 weeks, and then they lessened. And then what happened was slowly, over a period of months, because I went 11 months, the symptoms began to decline. And this was in accordance with Dr. Dante's expectations, so I continued. And it was not intravenous, so I did not have the infection risk associated with a needle in my bloodstream, etc. And so I continued on with it. I'm a conservative person, so I did not go the 18 months. I would have wished I had actually gone a little bit longer. But I came to the conclusion that clinical experience here, above and beyond the studies that attempt to evaluate the effect of long-term antibiotics, clinical experience was an important source of information. So many symptoms just disappeared. All the night sweats, which have been a big problem, drenching T-shirts many nights, they just stopped. My most symptoms never came back. A lot of important symptoms went away, like the knee problem, and it was limiting my life and things. However, they didn't all go away, and I wonder sometimes might it have been better to continue. But I did have a few continuing symptoms. But just to give one example, some doctors, when you come in with Lyme symptoms that persist, will say that they're subjective and psychological. I had twitching all the time. You know, my wife could look at my arm and see there it was twitching. And Dr. Dante's treatment did relieve the twitching. However, just little bits. After I stopped the antibiotics, after maybe 6 or 7 months, just a little bit of that came back. That indicated to me maybe that we didn't kill the entire population, if that in fact what was happening. It's interesting why the 11 months could be useful and why the IDSA believes long-term is not helpful. Very, very interesting. The life cycle of the Lyme spirochete is quite long, and I might talk more about this in a bit, but it goes into protective forms so that the immune system and antibiotics cannot reach it. There are so-called cystic and biofilm forms that it forces itself into. And it only comes out of these to reproduce periodically. So if the period is quite long, if it only does that recently, that you can understand why just a couple, 3 months of antibiotics might not get very much, and 11 might get more, and 18 might get more. And by the way, Dr. Danto was very open that there is no guarantee that even using his experience and approach, a certain number of cases are refractory. His argument was more that he did see benefit in a lot of cases, not that it was a complete solution. Anyway, so I gradually increased symptoms, but I was so much better. And my PCP tells me I have a very high tolerance for pain and things. So like I did for like 10 years or something, I just ignored the symptoms as they came back. They were so much less, but they gradually increased. Then one summer I had a tick bite. And so my PCP prescribed, just out of caution, doxycycline. And I had a severe reaction. It was just amazing to me how I had had doxycycline in the past for a tick bite. I had a physician who gave me one dose of it when I had a tick on me for a little while. And then I had been bitten one other time, and I was in right away, and I had the doxycycline. And it didn't bother me at all. But this time, I just couldn't function. I was really sick. I was laid up for 4 days. We headed out in the sailboat. We had to just moor the boat, and I was just an incapacitated sick person for 4 days. But interestingly, after that run of 4 weeks of doxycycline, my symptoms were relieved even more for a while. And that was a reconfirmation for me that the doxycycline helps. Now, before I mislead anyone, one thing needs to be said about antibiotics, which is they don't just kill biological organisms in your system. They're also anti-inflammatory. So one of the things to keep in mind is if you ever have antibiotics and it makes you feel better, that's not proof that bacteria were being killed. It might be just that the inflammation was lowered and you had an inflammation problem. So my point about all this is you need to be suspicious and you need to do critical inquiry about all of this all the time. You must always develop as many questions as you think you find solutions and keep investigating because nothing is completely clear. Anyway, so we have a situation where I took the doxycycline and I got sick. That kind of confirmed the Herxheimer theory, but as I say, those are my suppositions. Nothing is that clear through this whole process. There can be some internal certainty, but nothing in the way of scientific certainty. But as I continued on with these symptoms, which gradually increased over time after, because they did start to increase again after the doxycycline, very gradually, I noticed they were kind of on a 3-week cycle. And you know, you have to ask yourself exactly why there would be like a 3-week cycle or something like that. You know, I'm not sure that the psychogenic theory of all of this conforms to such rigorous cyclicity. Why is that? There are a lot of deep questions to ask yourself when you go into a doctor who's been schooled in the IDSA approach. He or she will tell you, well, we're not too worried about our thinking on Lyme because it's a spirochete, much like syphilis. And we know from syphilis, it can be killed effectively with the treatment of antibiotic. There's a good parallel there. My discovery about that was, first of all, that's a good starting point for thinking. But then you research further and you find that the amount of genetic material shared between syphilis and Lyme is not total. There's something over 30% of genetic difference. So there's a lot of evolutionary developments in these bacteria that might produce effects in the human body By the way, when I say 30% difference, that's, you have to think about that carefully, because the nature of all genetics is that we all, if you go back to the simplest, earliest life form, the most primitive thing, we all share such a massive amount of DNA. When I say 30%, first of all, look that up for yourself to check the actual figure, but in case I'm not quite right on there. But if you go back and look into that statistic, it means if you look at the genetic difference among bacteria, if you look at all bacteria and say, well, where do bacteria vary? Don't compare it, you know, to a parrot, or don't compare it to a gray seal. Just among bacteria, among those bacteria, there's quite a big difference between Lyme and syphilis. So anyway, in my mind, the cycle does seem to be conformant with the idea of a Lyme bacteria flare, if one accepts. I guess there's fairly good observational evidence now that the Lyme retreats into little cysts, microcolonies, biofilm, areas where they can protect themselves against the immune system and antibiotics. Anyway, that's my early experience with Lyme. It kind of gradually increased after antibiotics. And then progressing forward in time, because remember, this whole thing is over, I guess, 1990, that we're talking about like a 30-year period here. Moving forward, after that last treatment with doxycycline, it gradually increased, until eventually the pain in my leg and hip and, you know, the lower leg in the haunches, it became really pretty bad. So sometimes it was actually hard to do our daily walk. And the original doctor had retired. I actually at this point felt I needed some kind of treatment because, you know, I need to keep exercising for my health. And at this juncture, I'm going to actually recommend, even though I'm not recommending anything in this video, I'm going to mention something I do recommend, and that is always find yourself the best doctors with regard to their training and also with regard to their outlook toward their patients. And I was very fortunate to find a new doctor whose degree was from the medical school, which is ranked best in the country, and had 6 years in an Ivy League teaching hospital. And she took and led me through some further investigations that has been quite beneficial. As an aside, I'd mention here that I guess I would have one recommendation, and that is, when you're facing something that's possibly debilitating, what's very important, I think it's always good to have two advisors, and I found it quite useful to have an advisor in the traditional camp and then an advisor who is in the camp of having more general thinking and open to more possibilities, not really aggressively anti-IDSA, but just very, very open-minded. And by having these two types of doctors advise you, I find you can make a lot of progress in your own thinking and in figuring out what to do. Unfortunately, in the next round of treatment, I ran into a bit of a difficult situation, because, and it's very hard to interpret, because I actually had, without jumping to any conclusions as to why, I actually had sepsis, which is a cytokine storm, and was in the hospital with very serious symptoms. But who knows what caused that, because the timing is just terrible. Three things had happened. First of all, I had cleaned out big mouse nests at our camp, and it's well known that there's something called hantavirus, which can cause symptoms much like I had. Now, in our part of the country, hantavirus is quite rare, although it is documented. And this was quickly put to bed by another IDSA, another infectious disease doctor that I consulted, who said it can't be because I didn't have any flooding of the lungs. Well, I did my own research there and found out that there had been a U.S. government medical alert that there was a subvariety of hantavirus which did not have any flooding of the lungs, which we had used as a diagnostic criterion. So that meant that whole diagnosis was in question. However, I had the antibody testing, and it was found to be marginal, but it then didn't persist. So that was all kind of left up in the air. In the hospital, they saw signs of a possible atypical lung infection, but they were very suspicious because it didn't look quite right, and they doubted it all along. So it's possible that my sepsis was due to a lung infection. But at the same time, I had started a prescription with an antifungal nasal because I have polyps in my nose. And it turns out that had a biofilm buster in it, which I guess has the potential, unevaluated, theoretical, of disturbing biofilm colonies of Lyme. And who knows if a lot of Lyme might have been released or somehow if there was some other effect. But also I tried some antibiotics for my Lyme, and it's possible that I had a Herxheimer reaction of a very severe nature. But typically Herxheimer reactions with Lyme are less severe. And so that theory can be questioned. However, when you look into it deeply, there are cases where people get very severe Herxheimer reaction after antibiotic treatment for Lyme. So this whole area is just a puzzle what caused that. But it did make me very, very cautious about taking any more antibiotics to treat my symptoms, even though I was having trouble walking. Just to summarize, the outcome of all of that was that, again, in consultation with a very open-minded doctor, and this turned out to be prescient, what a prediction, there are certain herbal medications which are used so widely in traditional cultures and have been tested, so they're known to be relatively more safe, and one of these was felt to be active against Lyme and also the possibility of persisting babesiosis. And I tried that in very, very tiny doses and then a little bit more, and that really improved my symptoms a lot. I got so I could, mostly walk most days and manageable pain other days. So that's another dimension to all of this where you might want to, not saying to rush off to an alternative doctor, but try to seek advice from all sources and watch the literature carefully. I may talk a little bit about recent tests done at Johns Hopkins University, where it's found that doxycycline is not so able to kill all the Lyme, that doxycycline forces Lyme into protective cystic forms, but also that Lyme is more susceptible to an alternative cocktail of antibiotics that is not generally used. And finally, in this context, the point I'm trying to make is it's been tested against some traditional herbal medicines, and they were found to be more effective than doxycycline. So I don't view it, even though you should probably be very suspicious of what I'm saying here. I personally don't view it as scientifically insupportable or scandalous that one of these might have helped me. I was seeking a milder approach than antibiotics and felt so grateful that I found something. So that's quite interesting. I'm going to pause at this point for a moment. Okay, I'm back to continue talking about Lyme disease. I've said a number of times that I'm not making any recommendations except that everybody investigate for themselves. I did recommend a moment ago that in doing that, it's good to have more than one doctor advise you. That's always helpful when there's a controversy in anything. A second opinion philosophy is well accepted in medicine, and you might want an ongoing second opinion for Lyme disease for sure. But let me make another recommendation before I proceed, and this is something I found very useful for myself. It's not a medical recommendation. It's a recommendation about how to get advice. One of the things that I found as I looked into all of these questions was that there appeared before me many questionable sources of information. And I tried to look at credentials, and I wasn't too impressed in many cases. But again and again, maybe up to 7 or 8 times, I was really struck when I came across a doctor who seemed to have good, very good credentials and had somewhat open-minded and alternative philosophy toward continuing Lyme symptoms. And I discovered that these folks were doctors who had had persisting Lyme symptoms in their own family. So that can be very, very useful, I think, when you're looking for a doctor and somebody to advise you. You find a doctor, just think, a doctor with all this training, with a high IQ and dedication, and they spend all this time sacrificing much of their youth. How do you enlist them really as your best support system? Well, just think, if they've had Lyme in their family, a child, a relative, a sibling, a spouse, if that experience affects a physician the way it does most of those of us who have had continuing Lyme symptoms, what would you expect? You would expect a lot of careful thinking and research. So I would recommend always looking for doctors who themselves have had some experience with Lyme. Just to consider, it might be you find other sources which are better. But that will help. And generally, those physicians who have been close to the problem won't have this response that many other physicians do, that there could be a lot of subjective symptoms that maybe should be dismissed, might be depression, might be psychological phenomena, because they've been so close to it with people that they knew well. I mean, you can see why doctors think it might be subjective symptoms, because this is an area of medicine that isn't really well understood yet. And a lot of the symptoms associated with Lyme do show up as subjective symptoms. The doctors are quite right in having an open mind toward that. So it's a natural area of investigation. Whether it should be so much of a supposition, I'm not sure, but I certainly am understanding why doctors take that approach. Okay, so I've talked a little bit about my situation and approach, my philosophy and strategy. My philosophy is to try to be objective, like everything. There are known facts, and then around those known facts, there are mysteries, there are unknowns, there are scientific advances that will refine those facts. So the philosophy is to push both to advantage. People that have quite definite conclusions about what science has told us, and those who are trying to push the science further. Those are the two avenues that should be compared and contrasted. And you can see why I recommend finding a physician whose family member has continuing Lyme, because they'll have a dog in the fight on both sides. I'd warn you against many sites on the web trying to profit and take advantage. There seem to be many treatments without medical basis. And it's important to push past just whatever shows up on your screen and look for credentialed doctors who have treated many patients. As I say, we started to thousands of patients. It really helped in my own experience. The Lyme story is very, very complicated. And I personally think that we all need the guidance of both IDSA type and Lyme doctors. There are also doctors who are on purpose keeping themselves above the fray and keeping an open mind from both perspectives, and that can be really an advantage. But I myself have great fear of just rushing into the alternative view that, oh, it's Lyme and we just have to treat it with a lot of heavy antibiotics. I'm very suspect of that in case it might be something else. So just think of the advantage if you have two types of doctors. You have one doctor that checks out all the possibilities. Given your symptoms, what could it be? What could it be? Check them out. And only when you come down to the case where nobody can find anything, then you're in a position to better evaluate what the other camp might be saying. that this can be persistent Lyme infection. And good doctors with prestige credentials can really help with this. The possibility of getting misdirected here is really fairly major. So I think extreme caution is necessary in whatever you do. And we should talk a little bit about why you should even question the IDSA approach at all, given the fact that there are thousands of doctors in that camp, and there's been so much research conducted. I mean, we have to get on here at some point to ask ourselves, well, why would one question all that research? I don't actually think you should question it clinically. I don't think you should just jump over to the other camp myself. I think it's best to try to be very objective and very analytical. And as I say, critical inquiry is the thing that counts here. Accidental things may happen in your life. I've recently come across an established scientist with the very highest credentials. I mean, publishing in the very most prestigious international publications, and finding that he had to some extent the same experience, used the same doctor, and the same good result. So, you know, anecdotal happenstance can reinforce your view, but there's perhaps danger in just listening to any one person you run across. For me, that was after the fact, confirming some of my beliefs in my own mind rather than guiding me. Of course, there are many books on Lyme. You can consult those. One of the most extensive is a book by Dr. Horowitz, who's treated many patients. For myself, and this I think is a compliment, he finds so much complexity from his practice in what he calls multi-system theory. There was an involvement not just of Lyme, but many other factors. So much complexity that it's hard to find any solutions to somebody who's actually suffering. You would actually need him to guide you through the whole process. But it's interesting what he found. What he found was, as he treated patient after patient, I guess he found that it doesn't always just come down to Lyme, but many, many other things. And he wanted to test for all of these. And in some ways it's discouraging, because it confirms the IDSA picture that it might not be Lyme, it might be something else. But on the other hand, he often did end up treating Lyme, and he also often found other dimensions to human health which were very, very important to consider and treat. So that book, I guess that just helps one to understand how much complexity there is. I don't really know what to recommend in terms of specific steps for specific individuals, because we're all different. I would say that book is good to read if you want to understand the full complexity. I think he was on a national committee. I think he is somewhat respected in the general medical world, although strict IDSA practitioners would have one eyebrow up very much about his whole approach. Remember that the battle is between folks who feel that spirochetes may still live in your system and what one might think of as the persistent Lyme deniers, folks who feel strongly that, no, it's not bacteria that continue to live on. It's interesting in this regard that in my investigations of COVID-19, I've come to admire Michael Osterholm just tremendously. For me, just the best mind in the U.S., and he has just such a careful mind, such a trained mind. He himself mentions how many courses he did in statistics. He's at the pinnacle of American civilization, as are many of the doctors that I've consulted with. Osterholm himself is an epidemiologist, not a doctor. I don't know him at all. I just read his things. But it's interesting that in his epidemiological work, he just generally accepts the IDSA conclusions about Lyme and warns everybody against any other view. So this raises a really interesting question, which is at the heart of this whole podcast I'm trying to put together here, and that is, why should one at all have questions about the research that the IDSA refers to? I mean, these are smart people. They have available to them statistical consultants, epidemiologists, microbiologists, the whole works. And if you go out into the treatment world, you might very soon be told that there are four or five high-quality studies showing that longer-term antibiotics does not help. So isn't that just an open and shut case? High-quality studies respected by the best minds in American infectious disease science. Well, knowing my own shortcomings, and I remind you of them here, I remind you not to follow me so much in my thinking, but just to take my own journey as an example of how you might begin your own, and perhaps my recommendation that you try to develop questions to accompany any solutions you hear about. That might be very good advice. But what is the argument that IDSA might not really have the final answer? They have moved science ahead, there's no doubt about it. Well, what is a high-quality study? Well, it needs to be randomized and double-blind. Randomized means that you take two groups of people and use a random number generator or whatever to assign people into one group or the other, and so you get a good sampling. You get two good samples that are arbitrarily and completely randomly selected, and then you give one of these groups the treatment, like longer-term antibiotics, and the other group, you don't give the treatment. You give them a placebo. You trick them, make them think they're getting a treatment, but they aren't. And it's double-blind, which means the patient doesn't know if they had a treatment. In other words, they might have had pills to take which had antibiotics in them or didn't have antibiotics in them or injections or whatever. But it's double-blind, which means the people conducting the study and giving those treatments, they don't know either. Nobody knows which treatment or lack of treatment either group gets. So it's double-blind. Okay, so you run this study, and then you simply measure. You measure in some way, has there been a benefit of the treatment? Well, certainly the IDSE folks might have expected that there wouldn't be any benefit to long-term antibiotics, because in the case of the syphilis spirochete, the antibiotics tend to work, as I understand it, and they can even explain to themselves why folks have felt that long-term antibiotics helps, because it reduces inflammation, so a lot of symptoms can be reduced by long-term antibiotics. Long-term antibiotics are suspicious. That's the reason for these studies. Of course, there are a lot of other facts that they don't advert to, like the slow reproduction cycle of Borrelia, that's the Lyme spirochete, or the fact that the genetics are differentiating. It doesn't advert to the periodic nature of flares. It doesn't advert to the Herx reactions when you take antibiotics. It doesn't advert, well, it does, I guess. It doesn't give full credence to the fact that there have been studies finding live spirochetes. A very famous study by a researcher with a population of chimps took chimps that they infected with Lyme disease. Then they treated the chimps with doxycycline or antibiotics, much as you would a human. So now supposedly all the Lyme is cleared. Then they now recall that there's no way to culture and know if they still have Lyme in their body. So they took and they put fresh, healthy ticks on the chimps. These are ticks with no Lyme disease, and let them stay there a while. Then they took them off and they were able to look for Lyme disease on these in these ticks, and they did find some. So there's many reasons why the question should be raised. It's also been discovered that a cystic and biofilm forms of Lyme, which are less accessible to immune system and antibiotics, let alone perhaps for me, the most major question why we might ask for more studies than the four or five high-quality studies so far is I don't believe they were based on the clinical experience. You know, in my world, my scientific world, one looks at the folk order, develop the hypothesis, then goes to test it. So if you go out and you ask around among people that have treated thousands of Lyme patients and find that, you know, oral antibiotic of a fairly old and traditional type really helps if it goes on long enough, well, that tells you that the long-term benefits of antibiotics wouldn't just be a couple, 3 months. It would be much longer than that. There are also in vitro studies showing that doxycycline doesn't eliminate Lyme, and it encourages them to make protective cysts. It also shows that the in vitro studies also show that different sets of antibiotics might be more effective than doxycycline, which is traditional, and ceftriaxone and others, and that some relatively safe herbals can be more effective than doxycycline. There's also a study by a Brown statistician that found that I'm not sure about the more recent ones, but the early Lyme so-called high-quality studies were underpowered. That's a situation where the number of subjects interplays with the nature of the procedures and affects how certain one must be about the conclusions. So, to summarize all of this, one can ask this question. So we have double-blind studies, but should there be triple-blind? This is the main point I want to make. This is the question I have of both sides of the Lyme War. Should there be triple-blind studies? And that would be one where the design itself is blind to assumptions that might predispose the output. Perhaps the design of these studies set things up to get a negative conclusion. I would argue that if you have a physician with eminent qualifications who's treated 10,000 cases and is finding that long-term means many months, 12 months to 18 months, and he does see benefits, it seems to me that should be the null hypothesis in any high-quality study. That would be triple-blind. You go out there to the person who's really challenging your theories and has evidence, has actual evidence, clinical evidence, not actual studies, but clinical evidence. If you really want to put the question to bed, you have to say, well, perhaps Dr. Danta is the real thought leader in all of this, but he can be wrong. Let's find out. So that would be a way to end the Lyme Wars, in my opinion. If people designed a study that went a long time using antibiotics that are known to be more effective than doxycycline, and do it managing risk. I was never given intravenous antibiotics, just the same antibiotic that young people with acne took, and it was monitored the whole time. Anyway, you may agree, listeners here may agree with this or not. I'm open to the possibility that I might be completely wrong. I keep having these experiences, though, that lead me to make this podcast. I think I mentioned already meeting a scientist I admire so much and finding that he'd been down exactly the same path. But also, just recently, I saw that perhaps the most credentialed and learned Lyme researcher in the country had a web page associated with a clinical treatment in some lab associated, and talked about the great relief that came to this patient without using long-term antibiotics, and how encouraging that would be to folks with this problem. I mean, is Dr. Zhang right that there's 2 million of us? And it really made me doubt myself. And then I came across the same patient with a web page 2 years later, having to give up his primary occupation, his primary employment, because of increasing Lyme symptoms. So, you know, the IDS is right. You can't jump to conclusions. You get everybody in trouble, and it's probably it's highly advisable not to ignore what the IDSA is telling us, and do everything you can to avoid getting into trouble. After all, I had sepsis. I have no idea what caused that, but you can harm yourself by not listening to doctors. So I recommend you listen to IDSA certainly, but should you listen to other doctors as well? And should there be questions? And are there ways? I have been a scientist myself, and I think I see a way of resolving all of this, and that is a triple-blind study. Okay, I'd like to move on now a little bit and talk about another person that I admire so much, and that's Dr. Zhang at Johns Hopkins University. Major new results in the last few years from a prestige science center. I've already mentioned this above. I'm just going to run through the high points again. You might want to look at the research, evaluate it. You investigate here whether I've read anything wrong, if I'm drawing conclusions that are inappropriate. But in vitro, that means in a Petri dish, it turns out Lyme is not as susceptible to doxycycline as one might hope. But there are cocktails of antibiotics that do seem to be more effective. And almost, I shouldn't say comical, because suffering is involved here, but I did find it somewhat amusing that in this lab at Johns Hopkins, apparently they used doxycycline to create cyst and/or biofilm forms resistant to antibiotics so that they can go and test how various treatments affect those self-protecting forms, not just the open living, circulating spirochetes in the bloodstream, but ones hidden away protecting themselves. So that's quite ironic if you use doxycycline to create those, given that doxycycline is the standard treatment for Lyme disease. In this lab, they also found that essential oils can be effective, although there are warnings everywhere for patients not to jump to any conclusions. Essential oils can have bad effects. There are all kinds of questions about doses and things. These are not treatments at all, but just interesting questions. And then similarly, they showed that in vitro, once again, all this is in vitro, that several of the safest herbals, safest being in quotes, because there's much you must consider there in consultation with your doctor. Everything has side effects. You have to be very careful. Several of the safest herbals seem to be more effective than doxycycline. So is there hope there that some of these herbals that are in so-called toxicity tests, which is sort of chemical, shouldn't take that to mean that it's not harmful, that you need to research that on your own, but they're used massively in other cultures. So that's pretty much the narrative that I've had on my mind, and I thought it would be useful to share. I might summarize a little bit right now. The summary being that we're all going on the claim that there have been high-quality, randomized, double-blind trials showing that long-term antibiotics are not effective, which I think should be taken very seriously. But there are reasons why you might raise the question whether those studies might be done somewhat differently, the so-called triple-blind approach that I've suggested. One might find that long-term antibiotics, or according to Dr. Zhang's in vitro, that alternative cocktail of antibiotics might have more hope than the IDSA believes. Certainly, it's good for anybody designing a study to consult clinical experience and Dr. Donta's experience that over 12 or 18 months, a well-known antibiotic that's used for other purposes for long periods of time, that's in the same family as doxycycline, seem to show benefits for not all, but certain subset of his patients. Of course, the IDSA, we always come back to the fact that they're on solid ground in their warnings, because there are many doctors that have used intravenous antibiotics over extended periods, and the IDSA points out the dangers of antibiotics of any kind, but in particular the intravenous ones. Of course, Dr. Danta uses just oral. Even oral has some issues, even if different or less, but I'm not presenting any final solutions here. I'm just trying to raise questions, so I won't go into it all. An important thing to note is that of the five high-quality studies, they're mostly under 4 months, and it's often pointed out by Lyme investigators that there were benefits shown in some of these studies, even in those short time periods, just that they weren't overwhelming enough to revolutionize the theory of Lyme treatment. But it's certainly suggestive that perhaps if they had gone on longer, they would have seen more. And it's interesting, too, that the effects that they did see with longer-term antibiotics tended to be toward the end of the trials, like it was just beginning to kick in. And if you believe that Lyme has a slow reproductive cycle in the biofilm forms, it all makes a certain kind of sense. And after all, in the end, I would like a battery of advanced statisticians to investigate the conclusions of the Brown statistician, who felt that many of the studies were underpowered. I once was in a yogurt shop and hit up a conversation with an eminent statistician from Harvard, and I mentioned to him I was just interested in this question of underpowering, and his answer was he hasn't seen a statistical study yet that wasn't underpowered. Now, not to take that too far, but the point is there's always more to learn. Anyway, the IDSA has a general philosophy. They're not completely closed-minded. They have adverted to the possibility that there's a small amount of live bacteria after standard treatment, but are just, I think the belief has been that that's fairly inconsequential, and the belief is just that the persistence in monkeys in the studies I mentioned above is not significant. And the conclusion that they've come to is that these symptoms are very real. They're extremely palpable. They're very real in the patients. They're not dismissive anymore. They're very supportive, but they feel it must be the immune. They're believing it must be the immune system, effects, and also if there are dead spirochetes, that's a kind of a toxin which might be causing negative effects in one's system. From my point of view, I've gone to the immunologist and asked them, okay, so what do you have in terms of actual results here, actual studies? And they're saying that they've been saying to me that they don't have a treatment, they don't really have any useful results yet. So I'm wondering whether in every discipline, when things are hard to understand, just to maintain one's, not to be overwhelmed by the amount of detail and confusing facts. There's always a wasteback phenomenon. I'm wondering if people are just, if there really is an immune system response, I suspect others might be able to convince me that there really is. But if there's really an immune system response, or if in fact the folks are just saying, well, it must be that, because we don't believe in the live bacteria. Anyway, the insensitivity criticized by the Institute of Medicine, I think, is probably less of an issue, although I wish you luck if you hit physicians who are insensitive. I would just encourage you to pursue all the avenues you have open to you. Even these doctors who say it's just a post-Lyme syndrome, it's not live bacteria, and who say so that therefore there's no actual treatments, they will have palliatives, things to make you feel better available that can help. Their whole clinic's dedicated to that. And so the real question comes down to the one that I think is unresolved, but is resolvable. It really can be sorted out. Is it an immune response? Are persistent Lyme symptoms an autoimmune effect? I've already said one of the minds I admire most in all of American culture believes that. Or is there ongoing bacterial infection? Studies can be designed simply by respecting the other side of the argument to put this to bed. And I want to be open-minded. You know, the analogy to syphilis may hold a lot of weight since both are spirochetes. But they do differ dramatically in genetic content. And also, if you believe that essentially it's an autoimmune response, it's unclear how the immune system is infected. We're learning from COVID that we really don't understand as much as we need to about the immune system, so maybe there will be progress in the future. Actually, my own experience was that there wasn't really any solution for the syndrome. I pursued both lines of thinking and came to a conclusion that the best manner of approach was to take both sides seriously. Keep researching would be my final advice. Keep researching with an open mind. Really take every answer and present questions to it. So, for example, there's a very recent study showing that in Lyme, the very small nerve fibers are affected. This was never known before. New things will be discovered all the time. I'm going to pause again here for a moment. Okay, continuing once again, pardon me for the interruption. Please excuse the amateurish nature of this podcast. My little studio here has to be run by one person. I quite often sit with a significant amount of pain, so I apologize for my flat intonations. And if I don't bring the points alive as much as I would like to, let me just very quickly then summarize the high points. The conclusion is, and this is that this is not advice really of any kind, certainly not medical advice. The points I've been trying to emphasize is that Lyme disease in its continuing manifestation is complicated, many factors, and having advice from more than one source is very useful. It's ideological. There really is a difference of opinion about Lyme disease. So to fully educate yourself, it'd be good to have advisors who are open to both points of view, and in particular, advisors who have had Lyme disease in their own family tend to be folks who have looked into this very carefully. It's important to realize that much is unresolved. I mean, that's a reason why I would never tell anybody what to do here. I'm just saying to ask questions. When things aren't resolved, you know, not just a fear, but a knowledge that you'll tell people to do something and it will be wrong. So please don't believe me. My main point is the two sides aren't really listening in the most constructive way to develop the null hypothesis in the way that would be most useful. And if they did, I believe they could put questions to bed. So in your own investigations, I think the best you can do right now is find both kinds of doctors to advise. Look for good credentials. Look for folks who have had Lyme disease in their family. And get more than one point of view on the whole thing. So good luck in your own situation. And apologies for my own shortcomings. I'm aware that organizationally, in terms of content and coverage, much could be improved here. And I fully recognize the fact that I'm, like everybody involved in this, there will be areas where it will be found that I am wrong, like everybody else. Science is a process of refinement. And as you move forward, you would always revise what you might have said before. So in my mid-70s, I doubt there'll be a revision to this, but please know that there would be if this whole topic were revisited some number of years from now. Okay, thank you for listening.